Hey, welcome to your turn. Mike Causey here. Delighted to have you with us today. We're going to have a very interesting show. We have two of the top experts on the planet Earth about all things federal benefits-wise. Tammy Flanagan is well-known to listeners of this station. She's a columnist for Government Executive. She works for the National Institutes of Transition Planning, and she does webinars and she's always either here in Washington working or at her new home in Florida, recently retired, semi-retired. And Philip K. Gardner. Phil has been with the Office of Personnel Management for 38 years, okay?
Yes, sir.
2 years out with the Defense Department, but most of the time in benefits. And we advertised that both of you were going to be on today, and the email line has been humming. And so I'm going to go straight to the emails, and then we can sort of talk generalities here. But looking over these, I think you saw some of these and some of you didn't. This person says, this is Lynn. She says, I'm a CSRS offset employee with 37 years of service. About half my service time is regular civil service retirement system and half CRS offset. Considering my situation, would it be best for me to sign up for Social Security immediately when I retire at my current age of 64 or wait until my full retirement at age 66? I plan to retire this coming January. And first, what is CSRS offset?
Well, good morning, Mike, and good to be here. I'm going to go ahead and since we got Phil here, we're going to take advantage of his expertise. So maybe just give a short description of what is civil service offset if you find yourself covered under that system.
Okay, so CSRS offset was created in 1983. Social Security amendments of 1983 put most federal employees under Social Security. And initially, there was a CSRS interim for people who were first employed after 84 or with a break in service of more than 1 year. And on 1/1/87, people became either FERS, Federal Employees Retirement System, or CSRS offset. So under CSRS offset, you pay reduced SERS contributions and pay full Social Security. And at the time you retire at age 62 or retirement date, whichever is later, your benefits are offset based on the Social Security amount that's attributable to your federal offset service.
I've had more than one person tell me that of the three civil service retirement plans, the offset is the best. And that there were some people.
We do sometimes call it the best of both worlds,
yeah.
Because not only are you accruing civil service retirement calculation, which is more generous than FERS, but you're also fully covered by Social Security, so you can avoid some of the things we fear, like the windfall provision and the government pension offset. Sometimes you can avoid those when you're under the civil service offset. So if you play your cards right, you can end up with the best of both worlds. But there are some things to be cautious of, and I think Lynn's pointing out one of them, is that she's retiring, like Phil said, she's already eligible for Social Security at 64. So does that mean she'll immediately have her benefit offset? Like, how does that work?
Right. And what I would say to Lynn is that you're going to be, if you're eligible for Social Security benefits, you're going to be offset on when you retire, whether you're actually receiving it or not. I don't like to necessarily tell people what they should and shouldn't do, but I would just say you're going to be offset at retirement, whether you actually receive it or not. Some considerations are, do you plan to work? Might you hit the Social Security limitation in any given year? And if that's the case, then you probably should consider delaying receiving it. You're also possibly going to be subject to the windfall elimination provision unless you have somewhere between 20 and 30 years of substantial earnings. So
under
that's another consideration.
Security.
So
there's no simple answer in the government, is
no.
there?
No. But the other thing I'd add to her thing is that she may have another third source of income that'll allow her to delay taking Social Security if she's been saving in the thrift. So some people will use some withdrawals from the TSP account while they're waiting to reach the full Social Security age, or maybe she wants to take a spousal benefit if she's entitled to it and then delay her own, but she can't do that till she reaches full benefit age. So I would say don't do anything until you do a little bit more research on your options, because she does have options.
And I would also tell her to, you know, talk to their agency benefits officer, because they can fully counsel them about
on the amount of the
about
offset.
Yeah, all the amounts and things. And no one's going to tell you what to do, unfortunately. You know, we can only, our role in the benefits community is to tell you what what the options are and let you make the decision of what's best for yourself.
Yeah, got another one here, another offset. I'm CSRS offset with 29 years of significant Social Security income. Is there an accurate method to determine what my offset deduction will be? My HR person's estimate just uses the max with no regard to my 29 years.
So it depends on the software, right?
Yeah, it depends on the software. I think the 29 years of significant Social Security income really has nothing to do with the offset portion. That may have something to do with the windfall elimination or government pension offset for a survivor benefit. Really, the estimate that they provide you is one of the two calculations, and it's usually the total number of years of offset service you have divided by 40, and that's the percentage of your total Social Security benefit that the offset will be calculated on in your estimate. The alternate calculation is one that can't really be done until you do actually retire, and that's one where we actually take your full Social Security benefit, subtract out your non-federal portion of that, and the dollar amount that's left is the offset.
So it's the lesser of those two.
The lesser of those two, mm-hmm. Exactly. So it's really hard. Right. It's an estimate.
You can get pretty close with those estimates.
You can get pretty close.
And I've found, like, when I've seen
more.
Yeah, and I've seen that with both of those calculations you just described, 9 times out of 10, it's the one where you take the service divided by 40 because you're not going to have somebody with that much time under offset where the other one would apply. In many cases,
In many cases.
Okay, we'll bury offset for now then. But here's one from Mary Beth. She plans to work after age 65, but she says, "What do I do about Social Security and Medicare if I'm still working? How will it affect my health benefits? Do I keep it or do I have to drop what I have and go on Medicare?" Good question.
Okay, I'll take that one. So when you're still working for the government and assuming that you're still having your federal health insurance deducted from your paycheck, and you're not yet collecting a retirement check, then you can delay at least the Part B of Medicare.
Yeah.
You probably want to still enroll in Part A because there's no premium. Yeah, you might as well take that. But the Part B, you have a special enrollment period that occurs after you retire. So you'll have an 8-month window following your retirement if you're already 65 or older by the time you retire. And that's when you can pick up Part B and just pay the going rate, whatever everybody else is paying. On the other hand, if you have retired and you delay Part B, there is a penalty for late enrollment. So I think what Mary Beth is afraid of is that she's going to incur that penalty if she doesn't take it. But as long as she's still working, she can buy some time and not have to pay that Part B premium while she's still employed.
And a lot of people are doing that, and they're saving a lot of money by not paying that too.
Yeah, you avoid the penalty, just work forever.
Yeah. Got one here, which increasingly is happening.
Yeah.
Here's one from Doug. He says, "I'm CSRS. If I retire January 2nd, 2016, I'll get one day's salary in 2016 and payment for 440 hours of annual leave, 240 carryover, and 25 pay periods at 8 hours. Together, that will amount to more than $24,000. To more than the $24,000 TSP limit for 2016. Can the reimbursement for annual leave be used to satisfy the earning requirements so I could contribute $24,000 to the TSP in that first pay period in 2016? I'm so glad you're both here.
Well, it's a detailed question, but it really boils down to two things. One, I think there's a little misunderstanding here because he said if he retires January 2nd, which is a Saturday, and I'm assuming this guy is CSRS because if you're FERS, you don't want to retire January 2nd. You'd want to retire December 31st, most likely. But if he does that, he's going to get more than one day's pay in 2016 because the leave pay period 25 is going to be paid in 2016 as well as a whole week's salary. So he's going to really get 3 weeks worth of pay paid to him in 2016, and he can contribute that whole paycheck to the TSP. However, he's talking about the lump sum payment for annual leave, which he saved up a ton of annual leave. He's going to have 440 hours, which is going to be a pretty decent paycheck. Unfortunately, you cannot contribute to the TSP from your leave payment. So that is going to be money he's going to have to pay tax on. He won't be able to contribute that to the TSP because there's no provision yet to allow people to contribute from your lump sum leave check because it's not basic pay.
Okay. Here's one from Brian about the retirement checklist. He says, "I'm planning on retiring from the FERS program with 12 and a half years of service on January 9th, 2016. I turned 62 on January 6th, 2016. Mm-hmm. One, can I make my retirement date January 9th, 2016, and still receive my full annual leave payout, including hours accrued through January 9, 2016? Two, I have compensatory time on the books, and I'm planning to use those hours in my final week of employment, January 4th to 6, 2016. Does this plan sound reasonable? I know that by working on January 1, I will push out my FERS pension another month, but I'm okay with that.
Okay. Yeah, I agree with everything that Brian's saying here, because the first thing you said was he only has 12 and a half years service. And under FERS, you get 1% of your high three per year, right, Phil?
Correct.
Okay. Yeah. So he's going to get 12.5% based on his calculation here, 12.5% of his high three. And you compare that to what he's going to get in salary for working January 1st to the 9th, those 9 days of working is going to be worth more than 1 month of retirement. So I would go ahead and push the retirement until January 9th. And he is going to get paid for his annual leave through that date. The end of the leave year happens to be January 9th, so he's not going to lose any of the accumulated and accrued leave. So that's also going to be a good thing. So, yes, does this plan sound reasonable?
I think absolutely.
I think it does,
The commencing date is not really an issue for a FERS benefit that's only going to be based on 12.5% of their salary.
Exactly. And he's going to take advantage of one last accumulation of leave by waiting till January 9th.
We need to take a break here. We'll be right back on federalnewsradio.com, 1500 AM. Mike Causey, welcome back to Your Turn. Glad to have you with us here. I've been talking with Tammy Flanagan, well-known benefits expert, and Philip K. Gardner from the Office of Personnel Management. Phil's been with the government 38 years and always in this line of work, moving up, and spent all of his time at OPM except 2 years at the Defense Department. Right. Okay. Here's a fast question. Here's one question I can answer, possibly the only question I can answer. And it's from San Diego. And Louis wants to know, what time zone are you in? Which is not the same as what planet are you from. But we are in Eastern Daylight, Louis, so I hope you can listen to us. Got a lengthy question here from Bill. And he says, and he points out he is divorced, so he's not going to need coverage for anyone other than myself. I'm a current federal employee and retired military. I have 12 to 13 years as a Fed when I plan to retire in 8 or 9 years. I will have in 8 or 9 years. My question deals with using TRICARE for life and paying for Medicare Part B or signing up for the Federal Employee Health Benefits Program in the next couple of years so I can take that into retirement and not have to use Medicare Part B. I've been unable to find any comparison between TRICARE for life and FEHBP in retirement. Which would be the most cost-effective way for me to go? As for retirement income, I'll have my military pension, E9 with 20 years, Social Security, my FERS annuity, and my TSP. So I believe I'll be okay financially. And would you explain first what TRICARE is?
Yeah. We have Phil here, but we're going to get to him in just a second because his specialty, and this is really a good question, and all these questions really have really illustrated the fact that retirement, insurance, financial planning, tax planning, these are all different areas of expertise. So in a few minutes, we're going to get to Phil's area of expertise, which is really civil service and FERS retirement. So I'll take this one and talk about TRICARE and Medicare and FEHB. So first of all, TRICARE is military health care. Just like federal employees have FEHB, military folks have TRICARE and different varieties of TRICARE. So he's talking about the part of TRICARE that works with Medicare, which is TRICARE for life. So he's right. He's like, do I need TRICARE for life and Medicare A and B and federal employees health benefits? You know, how should I work this? So what you can do is while you're a federal employee, you can use the FEHB if you want to. And even if when you turn 65, TRICARE will drop you if you don't take Medicare. But if you're happy with the federal health benefit plan, you can use that until you retire, at least close to the time you retire. Then when you retire, you can sign up for Medicare A and B and re-enroll in TRICARE for life and then suspend your federal health insurance once you retire. In retirement, OPM will let you suspend the federal employees' health benefits as long as you're using TRICARE or a Medicare Advantage plan, or even if you're using the Peace Corps health plan if you happen to serve in the Peace Corps after retirement. So that suspension is not the same as canceling it. So if, let's say you move someplace, or let's say TRICARE might change in the future where you want to go back to FEHB, you could then cancel the suspension and go back in. So while you're working, you may want to use the FEHB. Once you retire, you can go back to using TRICARE for life with Medicare, because they're going to make sure you show them the Medicare coverage. In fact, I was looking at somebody's TRICARE card that's younger than 65, and it has an expiration date, which coincides with their 65th birthday. So the only way to get it renewed is to show that you're enrolled in both A and B of Medicare.
I'd just like to add one point to that, is that if you're planning on taking FEHB into retirement, you have to make sure you're actually enrolled before you retire. You can't pick it up once you're retired, but you can pick it up as an employee, and then, as Tammy mentioned, suspend it while you're receiving your TRICARE. And then re-enroll or activate your enrollment essentially at some point later on. But you definitely have to have your coverage on the day you retire.
Can you speak to that, Phil, for people who retire at the end of the year who want to get into TRICARE before they retire? Because if you enroll during the open season, it's not going to take effect till January 10th. But if you wanted to retire December 31st, you're not going to be able to have that FEHB. So would you have to do it the open season before you retire, like a year before?
Yeah, you absolutely would, because you have to be enrolled on the date of retirement. So having a open season change that's going to be effective after the date of retirement, or effective on the date of retirement, isn't going to work for you. So you would need to be enrolled at some point before you plan to retire, be that an open season or with a qualifying life event.
And retirement itself is not a qualifying life event.
Retirement is not a qualifying life event.
Right.
That's
correct. So you need to be very careful timing these dates, and don't let certain things expire and then try it again. Kind of a good segue into this one, is the five-year rule. I think everybody in this room has met somebody who has worked for the government longer than they intended to, because they got ready to retire. Maybe they had been piggybacking on a husband or a wife's health insurance plan in the private sector. And then toward the end, they realized that the federal program is absolutely flat out the best for retired people. So they say, well, I'll take advantage of the government program, and it's too late. What's the five-year rule?
You want to take that?
I will take that, because it's actually when we process agency retirement packages, it's actually the number one error that we find is people not having the proper documentation for the 5 years. So the five-year rule essentially says you have to be enrolled in the FEHB program for 5 continuous years immediately prior to your retirement, or at first opportunity and during all periods of subsequent employment, meaning that if you were to be, if you had less than 5 years enrollment, but you were, you know, part of your time was, say, non-deduction time where you were paying a deposit for it, and you wouldn't have been eligible for FEHB coverage. But if you picked it up when you were first eligible, when you got your career appointment, for instance, and had it for the full 3 years, say, immediately prior to retirement, that would meet the first opportunity and during all periods of eligibility requirement. And the thing I would say really you have to make sure is that 5 years out before retirement, that you make sure that you, if you plan, if you think you might retire on your first eligibility, then go ahead and get enrolled in FEHB if you want to have it into retirement. There are some opportunities for waivers of that 5 year requirement.
But don't count on it, right?
But don't count on it.
Yeah. And the other thing, too, is this always seems so literally penny-wise and pound-foolish. People will say they don't want to enroll in the federal program because of the premiums, but you can get a very cheap plan, you know, and there are several that are, premiums are very low, and that is what I call, that's buying insurance so you can have insurance. Mm-hmm. But you're then covered by one of the FEHBP plans. You may never use it. It's just, you're just paying money to establish your eligibility. But then when you get ready to retire, you can go into any FEHBP plan you want.
Yeah, correct. And I think a key point you said, Mike, is about the sort of the intricateness of the all the moving parts and all the different things you have to meet. And I think, again, I'll just make one more plug for your agency benefits officer. You know, they're there to counsel you and to make sure that, you know, you understand your benefits and what you can continue, what you can't. And so, you know, I think you really need to make sure that you talk to your agency benefits officer when you're making these kinds of decisions.
I remember years ago, the GAO, when it was the General Accounting Office, had a lengthy report about the federal civil service retirement system, and they said that approximately one-third of the people who take the oath, who sign up to be government workers and are sworn in, but about a third of them retired from the government, meaning two-thirds of them didn't retire from
the
government.
They
left early. The women maybe had children or for a variety of reasons. Now with FERS, I'm sure that's changed. This numbers because FERS is more portable, it's more transferable, and seems to be that people do more. I don't want to say job jumping as if it's a put down, but
yeah,
people
it's
want
more of
careers
the way people
in other places.
Their careers.
But yeah, I mean, I would think that notwithstanding that it's always important to prepare for retirement, but really maybe now more than ever, whether you're CSRS or the offset we had the questions about, or the majority now, the FERS employees. Right.
I do that a lot at mid-career planning seminars where I will tell people, always prepare for the what-ifs, because right now you might be thinking you're going to leave federal service, or you might be thinking you're going to stay a full career and you end up leaving. So know what you take with you when you leave. So if you do leave your federal career, understand the vesting requirements, understand how much of your TSP you take out, or do you leave it in? And so I think it helps you to prepare for life's changes, whether it's a career change or a change in your family situation.
And you have to keep in mind that even if you're going to be a deferred retiree, meaning you separate without title to an immediate retirement, but later get title, say at age 62, you can't pick up your FEHB enrollment.
Right.
And, a lot, that's a big part of it.
That's still one thing I think that keeps longevity in federal careers, because federal health insurance is one of those benefits private industry doesn't offer.
Correct.
Yeah. Well, and Phil, you mentioned something about the number one error, and it is that people, their records aren't straight, but in many cases they aren't eligible for they haven't complied with the 5-year rule. Is that the case?
More it's that they've had their 5-year coverage, but it's not properly documented. And
Is there something the employee can do? Let me set up an example. Let's say me and my husband, which we don't, both work for the federal government, and we have kids. So we've always been under his self and family plan. And now the kids are gone and they're over 26. So now we've decided to have two self-only plans instead of, or maybe a self plus one. So if we make that change close to retirement, where one of us isn't going to look like we have 5 years because we were on our spouse's family plan, would it be good for us to get a copy of that self and family enrollment so that we can show that when we retire with our agency? Or do they go out and reach for that from my husband's employer?
No, absolutely. I think being proactive is the way to go. If you've had you've been covered under a spouse's federal health enrollment for the last 10 years, and now you're going to go to a pair of self onlys, and you're going to look like you've only been covered for 2 years, say, when you go to retire. And the thing to do would be to provide your HR office with a copy of Standard Form 2809, which is the health benefits registration, or the electronic equivalents that so many of them are done online now. And make sure that your payroll office has one your HR office has ones that goes back long enough so you have the 5 years covered. So if you've made several changes in the last few years, provide them with copies of all of them.
Are most agencies now using electronic personnel folders? The ones I go to all seem to be.
Yeah, most, not all, of course. And you still have some people that want to handwrite out as SF-2809.
Yeah, because I meet a lot of people who don't know how to access their electronic personnel folder. Is there any way that you can help them understand how to go about that? Who do they contact, or is there an online presence for that?
Well, I think again, I don't want to keep singing the praises of the benefits officers at their agency, but your HR people know where all this stuff is and can definitely walk you through it, sure. They can walk you through the online enrollment process, how to see what's in your EOPF, whatever you need to do.
Okay.
Really.
Another short break here on federalnewsradio.com. We'll be right back. I'm Mike Causey here. I'm talking with Tammy Flanagan, benefits expert that's known by the entire federal world, and Philip K. Gardner, who's with the Office of Personnel Management, and they graciously permitted him to come on today. Phil, you gave me a really nice talking point sheet, and it mentions important dates to really start getting your retirement ducks in order, and you pointed out that five years out is a good time to start looking at things, in part, I guess, because it's one thing, it catches any problems with the five-year rule.
Yeah, that's correct. Not only that, but it, you know, some people are in the wrong retirement coverage, and the earlier that's found, the better it is for them, because they get some special elections under the Federal Erroneous Retirement Coverage Corrections Act. So, for instance, if you have an error in your coverage, it's much better to find it out 5 years while you still have time to sort of take some of the perks that come with having that error.
So what does that mean, like 5 years planning? Does that mean go get an estimate and that's how you would find out that there was a problem? Or how would an employee know that they're in the wrong plan?
Well, you know, a lot of there, of course, it's, I'm going to use the acronym FERCA, which is for the Retirement Correction Errors. And we put out an awful lot of information on FERCA. And back in the early 2000s, people were self-identifying. Agencies were finding their own FERCA errors. Nowadays, when it happens, unfortunately, too often is when someone's actually submitted their retirement application and they're asking for an estimate, and someone goes through and looks at their records and sees, lo and behold, there's a retirement coverage error there. Well, if, for instance, if they're erroneously in SERS or SERS offset and wanted to be in FERS, now they don't have necessarily time to do any TSP makeup contributions or anything. So the handbook is the guide, the SERS and FERS handbook. It's sort of the Bible for federal benefits officers, exactly. And we talk about advanced retirement planning. We talk about a five-year period before retirement, one-year period, 6 months, and what you should be thinking about that. So really at that five-year point, you're looking at, have you made your civilian or military deposits? That's for civilian service where you didn't have deductions taken or where you took a refund, or military service deposits. Documenting prior service, making sure all your service is documented, and that's where the retirement errors are often discovered. If you plan to take FEHB or your insurance into retirement, or life insurance into retirement, and you haven't even enrolled yet, well, that 5 years is sort of that magic number to have the 5 years for eligibility. And there's just those things to think about.
Would you still recommend that federal employees keep a copy of their personnel folder when they leave the agency to go out into retirement, just to make sure that if something did come up where their agency estimate might be different than the OPM actual calculation, they can understand where it came from?
It's not a bad idea. I mean, I know not everyone's going to keep, I think I may have every SF-50 I've ever received.
Anybody who's ever worked in HR has every SF-50.
Either paper version or definitely, yeah. I've even, you know, the sin of printing it out, you know, when it's a digital record. But hey, you never know when something's going to get lost.
It doesn't take up that much space in your drawer. It really doesn't.
I have a little area in my desk just where I have all those records. So
hey, let me go back to something here. And I remember, you know, 10 years ago, this was a big issue, that people would find out they were in the wrong retirement plan. But A, how can that happen? And there are still people out there who may well be in the wrong retirement plan?
Yeah, there are still people that are in the wrong retirement plan. And I think it's a function of the coverage rules have gotten so complex. You have special rules if someone's been performed service in another federal retirement system, say, such as a foreign service pension system. The Social Security rules get complex. You start dealing with District of Columbia government employees who aren't truly federal employees, but were included in SERS by law.
And then you add in the non-appropriated fund employees who come back from different military bases. How do you treat that service?
So, right. You get the NAFI and all the different election opportunities they have. I mean, it's a really...
Now, I usually tell people, if you were rehired after 1983 or if you had a change in agency, it doesn't hurt to take a look at that coverage and just to make sure you were put in the right place.
Yeah, I would totally agree. If you had a break in service after 83, really, if you were employed any time since, and if you've been first employed after 82, for instance, when you would have had the 5 years as of 12/31/86.
So, that's true.
Well, what if they discover that I've been in the wrong retirement system for 12 years?
Or 30
and
years.
Or 30, and I'm going to retire tomorrow or 3 weeks from now. I mean, do they make me whole? Do they go back? I don't see how. I mean, you're looking at, and correct me if I'm wrong, if it's a civil service retirement system, you're looking at a better annuity, a larger annuity, fully indexed inflation anytime. If you're in the FERS program, you have a reduced annuity, but there are all those years, 5, 10, 20, 30, where you could have been putting money into the thrift savings plan, and you could make a case that you'd have a larger total pile of money.
Like Phil said, if you're in that wrong system, you can go back and catch up. If you have the money laying around to catch up, you can catch up your TSP if you discover that. And that's a cool thing to be able to look back at what the stock market did and said, do I want to do this or do I not?
Well, yes and no. Now, you can't. There's only one way TSP contributions can be made, and that's through salary, through a working salary. So someone who's retiring and then finds an error isn't going to have that opportunity to do any makeup.
You had to put all your salary in. Or
to do any makeup. And you don't get to rewrite history, depending on when, how far back in the TSP time you're going. You could either get the greater of the G fund or the average of all funds prior to 2000. And then from 2000 on, the money's only going to be distributed between your historical your historical contribution or allocations.
What you would have done.
Right. So this is all under what I called the acronym FERCA. And to really be made totally whole, the earlier that error is found, the better. And way too many times, the error is found at the time of retirement. If someone wants to rewrite history, as you called it, Tammy, and move back to FERS and get all that TSP money and the matching funds and lost earnings and such, they need time as an employee to actually make those makeups.
Yeah.
They can't write a check for what they missed.
No.
Do you, for someone who's hired or rehired after 1983, should they all be checking to see that they're in the right system?
I think that's good advice.
It
really?
Wouldn't hurt.
Uh-huh.
No, it wouldn't
it
hurt.
Doesn't hurt.
Okay.
Sometimes the employees intuitively wonder, like, it seems like I should have been this, but I'm that. And if you have that sneaking suspicion that you might be in the wrong system, you might be right. So ask an HR specialist to take a look at it.
This is the civil service version of getting a DNA test, isn't it? To see who you really are.
See who the father really is.
Yeah.
Well put.
Okay. Phil, you mentioned doing a checkup 1 year out and 5 years out. You know, every administration, this one, the last one, the one before it, they all say they want the best and brightest. They use different terminology, but that's what they want. They want to be more inclusive. They want to get more bright young people, and they want to keep them. Presumably, they're telling the truth, but, you know, who knows? It would seem to me that if I were in an agency and I had the best and brightest, and these are people maybe a year or two out of college or just bright high school kids that you brought in, it would seem to me it would behoove the agency to have a briefing for them, a good briefing, like a pre-retirement seminar, and say, look, you've only got a year under your belt now, maybe two, but this is what you're looking at. Mm-hmm. Check out the private sector. The pension benefit can't be beat. The thrift savings plan match can't be beat. The federal, the health insurance can't be beat. And that might be a way to keep some of these younger people from straying, you think?
Well, obviously, federal benefits are a excellent perk and a good way to attract the best and brightest, for sure. Most agencies have a program of that they put new employees through. But if you think about it, you first walk in the door at 22 years old, which is how old I was when I walked in the doors of OPM. I didn't think a thing about benefits. I certainly didn't even probably anticipate being in the federal government that long.
Yeah, there's one agency I go to. They call it a prepare class for employees who have 5 years on the job, which I think now you got their attention because now they've been here long enough that they know the ropes, they know their job, and now you present them with this more detailed benefit information where they really do ask a lot of questions. So you're right, Phil. You know, somebody right out of school is going to be more concerned about, you know, doing their job than worrying about their retirement. But catch them 5 years in, now we got them on a glide path, and I think that's a good idea. I wish more agencies did that.
Well, we have the financial literacy program and retirement literacy program now that OPM
some agencies
champions,
are really,
and we have agencies doing financial fairs and things like that. And it's all part of it, making sure people understand their benefits because, you know, and how it might work in conjunction with anything they may have of their own, such as IRAs and such. So there's a lot of information available out there. The main keep blowing the agency benefits officers' praises. But
yeah, read those emails that come from your benefits office.
Exactly. Read those emails.
Well, I, you know, thinking about, you do think about certain things at certain ages, but I know when I was with the Washington Post, I was going to do a column about retirement, and we need to take a break here, and I'll tell you coming back, but remember that word, Washington Post retirement, here on federalnewsradio.com, 1500 AM. Hey, welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey here, talking with Phil Gardner from the Office of Personnel Management, Tammy Flanagan from all over the place, Government Executive Magazine, National Institutes of Transition Planning, and Tammy is a regular on the For Your Benefit show here on Federal News Radio Mondays. Is it 10 to 11?
That's correct? Right. Next Monday, we are going to talk about service credit, which kind of relates to what we were just discussing
before the break. Okay, good, yeah. And if you didn't hear the first part of the show, we are archived on the homepage, and you can tell other people. But the fact that the possibility exists that if you came into government after 1983 or had a break of service or something, you may be in the wrong retirement system.
Yeah, and that it still happens. Unfortunately,
could be
it does
a problem.
Still happen.
Yeah. Yeah. I was going to tell a war story before the break. When I was at the Washington Post, I was doing a piece about the government retirement system, and I wanted to contrast it to a large, very generous corporation, and what better than where I worked. So I called our personnel office and said, when is the last time Washington Post retirees got a cost of living adjustment? And how much was it? And she said, what's a cost of living adjustment? That was my answer. And so, you know, when you're looking at benefits, one of my sons recently changed jobs, and he went with a place that gives a 5% match, which is unheard of outside of the government. But it's a small...
But probably because he doesn't have a pension.
Yeah, well, yes, there you go. No defined benefit. But he gets it. He's been force-fed enough of my columns to know that this is the equivalent of 5% tax deferred pay raise, yeah. And it's just, it's huge, you know, over time, over 10, 15, 20 years of getting an extra 5% put into your TSP.
That's... See, well, I meet people a lot of times, like my son's friends and stuff, that say, well, we don't contribute to our company's 401k because we might not stay there. It's like, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
You put the money and they match it. Usually it's yours.
Exactly.
Yeah, so don't hesitate to contribute because you can move it from one company to another with your 401k.
Right.
That's very portable benefit.
And you know, you look at the Federal Retirement Thrift Investment Board's figures, how many people move money into the TSP from, you know, and most of these are wealthy attorneys who come in as either government attorneys or as federal judges.
Yeah, but anybody can do it.
But I mean, they'll bring in $500,000.
Right.
These are not financial dummies, and they've looked at all the options, including keeping it where it was, and they jump into the TSP.
All about the fees.
Yeah. Okay, does money in the TSP or FERS retirement have protection under ERISA?
Yeah, your money in the TSP is not protected under FDIC or ERISA would be the spousal protection.
Well,
right?
SERS and FERS are specifically ERISA exempt. I'm not sure about TSP, but SERS and FERS are ERISA exempt.
Well, I think it's because SERS and FERS under Title V of the U.S. Code and the TSP as well is under different law than, say, 401ks or IRAs. So there are spouse equity provisions.
Right,
they're just not
equity.
Exactly the same.
Well,
exactly.
This will make some people laugh, too, but they do have the safety and full credit of the U.S. government. So
that's true. And there's still something to be said for that.
If those two went by the board, we'd probably be in bad shape all around the place.
Yeah, I guess the ERISA laws are more for spousal protection, and there definitely is spousal protection under both TSP and OPM benefits.
Right, because of the spouse equity legislation.
Mm-hmm. Got about 4 minutes left to talk here. What are some things you want to hit and alert people to?
Did you want to say anything about phased retirement? Because I know where I'm starting in my seminar, starting to get some questions about it.
Yeah.
Is there a way, like if the agency says you can do it and you work it out with your supervisor, like what? How does that work?
So phased retirement's an agreement between the employee and the agency. And it starts with a discussion with your supervisor to make sure that you can do it. And then there's you can essentially apply for phased retirement. I think it's the... Standard Form 3116, which is sort of an election to enter into phase retirement, and then the part of it's an agreement to end it. And just keep in mind, no one's in, it's not a right, phase retirement's not a right. It has to be work for you and your agency's purposes. And
is there a mentoring? I think there's a 20% mentoring requirement.
There's mentoring requirements.
That the agency will discuss with you as
well. Correct. Because
I would imagine not all positions are mentoring type positions where you would even have the opportunity to do that. So like you said, Phil, it's got to be something where the agency has the means to do it for you or to provide it for you.
Well, you know, when the background is, it's almost 3 years now, but when Congress authorized it, as everybody knows, the devil's in the details. OPM took a look at it and they made a decision, which I think most people think is very wise, to kind of let agencies do their own thing within certain limits. Mm-hmm. And as it turns out, the Library of Congress was one of the first. That's not your sort of run-of-the-mill federal agency. Housing and Urban Development has now adopted it, Environmental Protection Agency. Experts like me, who predicted the Defense Department would do it first, were, of course, 100% wrong. But they're doing it, and HUD is not the Library of Congress, and the Library of Congress is not EPA. And when they started, and so some agencies may not offer it at all, but OPM has given them the way to design it for themselves. But I think one of the only consistent factors is that they have to devote half their time to 20% of the time to mentoring.
And work 50% of the schedule.
Okay. Anything else? We got a couple minutes here.
Couple things I wanted to talk about is just what can an employee do to ensure that their retirement case goes smoothly?
Yes.
We've talked about this 5 year out, 1 year out. I would just say that, you know, you want to make sure that your records are complete at some point, be it 5 years out, be it 1 year out, to make sure that your agency has documentation of all of your service. If you have military service, make sure that they get the member 4 copy of your DD-214.
Great. Thank you, Phil Gardner. Thank you, Tammy Flanagan. We'll see you here next week. Have a good week.